Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with disarray in the British Prime Minister Theresa May's cabinet following the resignation of her chief negotiator on Brexit, David Davis, who is joined today by Britain's Foreign Minister Boris Johnson, who quit in protest of May's Brexit plan. The author of Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union, Harold Clark, the co-investigator of the British Election Study at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor, joins us. We'll discuss this political earthquake rattling the British government, which is likely to lead to a leadership challenge and a power struggle within the ruling Tory party, who hold a slim majority. And with President Trump scheduled to visit the UK on Thursday, we will assess what further mischief Trump might cause, given his support for Brexit and his sympathy for the Brexiteers like Boris Johnson, who make rosy promises about a halcyon new world of free trade, while wanting a crash exit or hard break from Europe, and damn the consequences. Then, with today's death of a British citizen from contact with the Russian nerve agent Novichok, which was used in an assassination attempt to poison Sergei Skripal, a former Russian spy, and his daughter, we will look into how callous and sloppy Putin's poisoners appear to have been in discarding the container of the deadly nerve agent, which was smeared on the door handle of the Skripal's home in Salisbury, resulting in the collateral damage of a lethal dose killing Dawn Sturgis and leaving her partner Charlie Rowley critically ill. Luke Harding, the former Moscow bureau chief of The Guardian and author of A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko and Putin's War with the West, whose latest book is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House, joins us to discuss the growing outrage in the UK. Then finally, we will speak with David Diane, a contributing writer to Salon.com and The Intercept, about his article in the Los Angeles Times, The US Bullied the World to Stop a Pro-Breastfeeding Resolution. That's the American Way. We will analyze the attempt by the Trump administration to remove language from a resolution at the World Health Assembly to, quote, protect, promote, and support breastfeeding, at the behest of the big corporations who make baby formula, which they are marketing to the third world with misinformation, creating a black market in diluted formula, which is crippling the growth of children whose parents cannot afford the costly formula. And joining us now is Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas, who has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. He's the author of Austerity and Political Choice in Britain, and his latest book is Brexit, Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Clark.
Hello, Ian.
So, Harold, the cabinet of Prime Minister Theresa May of the UK is in total turmoil. There's an expectation that there'll be a leadership challenge. Already, the chief negotiator for Brexit, David Davis, quit, and then that was followed today by the resignation of her foreign minister, Boris Johnson, who was an original champion of Brexit. So, what do you think is going to happen there with both what appears to be a looming leadership challenge within the cabinet and all this happening just days before President Trump arrives, and we know about his support for Brexit?
Well, I wish I knew, Ian. It's obviously total chaos and a major defeat for Theresa May, and we can't rule out a leadership challenge. They need 48 MPs, conservative MPs, of course, to sign a call for a leadership contest, and I think that certainly is possible. And, of course, there's also the possibility that the government might just fall outright and there'll be another general election, which, of course, would be the third national vote in 3 years.
And how narrow is their majority, the Conservative Party's majority?
Well, the Conservatives, of course, actually don't have a majority by themselves in the House of Commons, and they're able to govern only with the support of the Democratic Unionist Party, one of the Ulster parties, which is, you know, the conservative, small c conservative party propping up the government right now. So already they're in a perilous situation, and you know, it's very possible that the government may actually fall over this matter, and they would then be forced to the polls whether they liked it or not.
So my understanding is that the Brexiteers, led by Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage, have never really been honest about their real intentions. And it's obvious from the beginning that this thing was a mistake because they can't figure out how to make it work unless they go the radical route, which I believe is the ultimate dream of the Brexiteers, which is just a total break with Europe and let the free market determine our future in this kind of rosy sort of halcyon idea of libertarian global economics.
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, a considerable truth in that, that, you know, what happens after Brexit has always been, you know, the major question, and indeed fears about the economic consequences of Brexit were, you know, a major but not, of course, a determinative factor in the vote back in June of 2016, and it's an issue that hasn't gone away. And you can see that it is still playing a huge role. And so I think you're absolutely right about this. Brexit is being driven without really a lot of thought about what will ensue afterwards. And, of course, in order to make a Brexit happen, they have to have, you know, a cooperation from the European Union, unless they just crash out, as they say. And so I think you're absolutely right on this.
Well, but since it's not working and it was a stupid thing in the first place and it was ginned up by a bunch of xenophobes who used TV advertising and Cambridge Analytica to create this mood of fear that England was going to be overrun by brown-skinned Islamists and lose its Christian identity, which is, you know, the pervading kind of anti-immigrant narrative across Western Europe. It was very dishonest to begin with, but it's manifestly clear that they don't know how to implement it. And May's plan is what's blown up in her face with Davis and now Johnson leaving a cabinet, and others will probably follow suit. Why not just have a revote? Because if my understanding is the vast majority of the British public have figured out this was a terrible mistake and they would like to get out from under it.
Well, I think in fact, though, like what our surveys are showing, is that there really is still not. Now, it may well change in light of our recent events we're talking about. There has not been a strong sentiment across the electorate for a second vote on Brexit. And opinion on being in the European Union has moved in a pro-Remain direction by only a very, very small margin. So public opinion has been very, up in the air on this as well. Now, what's happened in the last day or two may well, you know, settle things in a pro-Remain direction. But I think it's more likely that the real danger is the Conservative Party may irrevocably split over this, Ian. I think this is a real possibility.
Well, if they do split and there is another election, obviously the Labour leader will get in. And Jeremy Corbyn has not distinguished himself on the matter of Brexit. He waffled on it when it was up originally, and he could have, if he had made a real stand, stopped it. I'm obviously wrong in suggesting that the majority of the British public recognize that it's not workable and it was a mistake. That seems to be the objective evidence, but you're saying it's still a very close call and that those that would want to remain in the EU are a small majority, but that could change, right? That's what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. These are really, large-scale events that are unfolding now, and it may well crystallize public opinion in a more Remain direction. Or, as I say, the public may remain largely divided and the Conservative Party will actually split. It's sort of reminiscent of things from the 19th century and so forth. This is a long-standing division in the Conservative Party, of course, concerning relations with Europe. But now I think it has reached the point where the party may actually fall apart over it. I think you're right also that if there's another election, that one way or another, this will open the door for Jeremy Corbyn to come to power. He might not have an actual majority of Labour MPs, but would form some kind of coalition to support a minority government.
So with President Trump showing up in the UK on Thursday after his NATO meeting before his summit with Putin in Helsinki, obviously there's going to be an enormous amount of protests and the giant balloon of the baby Trump will be floating on the skyline, perhaps even noticed by the president. So we know that Trump is a big supporter of Brexit, and his people, like Stephen Bannon, who used Cambridge Analytica along with the Mercers who owned it, helped elect Trump. And it looks as though Brexit was the trial run for their data mining and micro-targeting through social media, which was very effective in both Brexit and much more effective in the election, which Donald Trump barely won with 3 to 4 million votes short in the popular vote. So Trump is doing all kinds of mischief, openly attacking Angela Merkel. And of course, we know he's been saying terrible things about the Canadian Prime Minister after the G7.
Yeah, yeah.
So is he likely to be a bull in a china shop here? Because I think he's much closer to Boris Johnson. I don't think he has a lot of respect for Theresa May.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so either. I think he'd perceive her as being very weak, especially the way things have gone recently. I mean, it's not inconceivable, depending on how fast events are moving in Britain, that he might actually just cancel his visit and come back to the United States. And we just don't know what's going to happen. This is an incredibly fluid situation, as we've discussed, and so it's not inconceivable to me that he would simply decide that he's better off coming home.
Well, he'd have to go to visit Putin before he came home.
Well, that's right. I mean, he can do that, but not go to the UK and come on home. I mean, it's not inconceivable if there's a crisis in Britain as well that he would cancel his meeting with Putin even. Or delay it. But, there are so many imponderables with the British situation and with an American president like Donald Trump. I don't think I'm going to want to bet a lot on what's going to happen over the next week.
Well, he could spend an extra day or so at his golf course in Scotland, which he plans to visit in any case, right?
Yes, that's indeed he could. Indeed he could.
Yeah, I don't see him canceling on Putin. Putin may well
no,
be.
No, I think that's very unlikely.
Yeah, that might be.
It would provide him with a very nice excuse if, in fact, he decides, and he's very impulsive, that for whatever reason he wants to do this. I wish I could offer guidance as to what the way forward is going to be in the UK, but I don't think anyone really knows. One thing that I should add, of course, is that the EU negotiators, this is exactly what they hoped would happen. By moving slowly on Brexit, by slow-walking negotiations, they were hoping, much like Mr. McCobber, that something would turn up, and indeed it has.
Well, this negotiation that they've objected to, that Theresa May was engaged in, that wasn't very realistic in any case. So what do you make of efforts by George Soros, who's been vilified in Hungary, as you know, by the new right-wing government there? He's apparently trying to get behind a revote of Brexit. Where is that standing? We talked about it before, that it may get some wind at its back as a result of this political turmoil, assuming that the Tory government collapses and there's a new election and Labour wins. But what do you make of George Soros' efforts?
Well, I think it might be a very, the idea of a second referendum might be a very convenient tool for Jeremy Corbyn, where he can basically say, well, let's just let the people decide, since he had waffled so much. And I think in his heart he's not really pro-European. He views the EU as this great capitalist club, so that indeed if someone like Soros was helping to move public opinion in this direction, it might be something that he could, that is, that Corbyn could latch onto quite conveniently.
But is Corbyn so far to the left, like a lot of American European leftists, and particularly in the Eastern Europe, that make excuses for Putin, that they don't recognize what he's up to? You'd have to be pretty blind in the UK not to be concerned about Russia, particularly with what's happening now with the poisoning of a British citizen. It looks as if the Russians who poisoned the Soviet spy, the Russian spy in Salisbury, were very sloppy and left some of the Novichok behind.
Yes, it does. A tragedy. It's a real tragedy. I don't think anyone would have thought that this would happen. Ian, one of the things to recognize about opinion about Corbyn is there's a huge generational divide. For older people, they have memories of the Soviet Union and the Cold War and so forth that are not shared at all by young people. Young people view Corbyn very differently as a sort of something new, something novel, a fresh breath of air, and his ideas about providing free goods and services to people are very attractive to them. Why? They say, well, free stuff, why not? It sounds wonderful. So there's a real divide in terms of how people see Corbyn. And it's not just in partisan political terms, but it's very much across generations.
Well, Harold Clark, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure, as always, to talk with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He's been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And he's the author of Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. And his latest book is Brexit: Why Britain Voted to Leave the European Union. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the death today of a British citizen from contact with the Russian nerve agent Novichok used in an assassination attempt to poison a former Russian spy and his daughter.
So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from the UK is Luke Harding, a journalist, writer and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrets. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his books have been translated into 30 languages. And his latest book is Collusion: How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luke Harding.
Thank you.
So the death of Dawn Sturgis from Novichok poisoning, and the fact that her partner, Charlie Rowley, is still in critical condition. Obviously, there's a lot going on at the UK, particularly at the top level of government, with total disarray within Theresa May's cabinet. But if we go back to the G7, my understanding is that Theresa May was hoping to get a joint resolution condemning Russia for the earlier poisoning of the couple, the Skripal and his daughter. But Trump kind of threw a spanner in the works by preemptively announcing before he left for the G7 that he wanted to readmit Russia. So is this having any effect on the broader issues, given that President Trump will be visiting the UK at the end of this week?
Well, you're right. It's been an extraordinary few days here in the UK, and I think normally the death of Dawn Sturgis, who, let's be clear here, was just, it seems, an innocent victim of a lethal nerve agent strewn around Salisbury, a rather ordinary kind of provincial town in the west of England, by seemingly a Russian assassin or Russian assassins, would be the number one story. But of course, as you say, the British government is in disarray. The UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has resigned. Two, three other ministers have followed him. And clearly there's a kind of crisis at the top of the Conservative Party, questions about Theresa May's future. And all of this means that actually comparatively little attention has been paid to what's been happening in Salisbury and Wiltshire. And it is the most extraordinary story. We had in early March, really an attempted assassination of Sergei Skripal, a former Russian military intelligence officer who'd been living in the UK since he was swapped out of Russia in a spy exchange in 2010. They survived. The authorities told ordinary residents that it was safe to go back to work. A couple of weeks ago, they unsealed various parks and other areas in the center of town which had been boarded off. And then we have this tragedy of a woman of 44 years old and her partner, who appear to have handled something. She is dead and he is critically ill.
And my understanding is that her partner, Dawn Sturgis' partner, who's still alive but in critical condition, Charlie Rowley, both of them had a history of substance abuse, and perhaps their liver and their immune system wasn't up to par. But still, my understanding is that Charlie Rowley is a sort of what we'd call over here in the US a dumpster diver, somebody that sort of rummages through trash. Is that a possible explanation for how he would have come in contact with whatever it was that poisoned them both?
Well, I think this is the most probable scenario. The counterterrorism police, who've been investigating what's now a case of murder, they're classifying this as murder, say that they think it's highly likely that the Novichok, which killed Dawn Sturgis and as you say, has kind of critically injured Charlie Rowley, was of the same batch that was used against the Skripals. In other words, they don't think it was a second plot or an attempt to kind of come back and confuse everybody. They think it was left on an object. We don't know what kind of object. And that Dawn Sturgis had picked this up. We know from the police that the area of contamination was her hand. She clearly touched something, and there's now a massive search underway to try and find this object and to reconstruct their movements since they both fell violently on June 30th. And it may be that it was something that was tossed into the undergrowth. We know from friends they would sometimes pick up discarded cigarette butts and scrape out a bit of tobacco. I think what's interesting here is if you cast your mind back to the murder in 2006 of Alexander Litvinenko, another Russian former intelligence officer who decamped to London and was murdered, we now know, by two Kremlin assassins who killed him with a radioactive cup of tea, famously, in central London. But we discovered from a kind of public inquiry in 2016 that these assassins had also chucked spare poison down the hotel sink, had left a towel out contaminated with radiation. In other words, collateral damage, other human victims, is not something that figures greatly when the Kremlin thinks about these kind of operations. And it seems here that this was just a tragic unintended accident of this plot back in March.
But going back to the Skripals, the assumption is that the Novichok was somehow smeared on the door handle of their home. So whatever the container it came in may well be what we're talking about in terms of having been killed, Dawn Sturgis and poisoned Charlie Rowley.
Well, that's right. I mean, bear in mind that there's been a major, massive police investigation, and initially the thinking was that perhaps they had been poisoned near or close to the bench in the centre of Salisbury where they were found, Yulia and Sergei Skripal, and then subsequently forensic tests showed that someone had, one imagines, in the middle of the night, smeared Novichok on the front door handle of Sergei Skripal's house. And I've seen it. I mean, it is in a very sleepy little corner. It's a little way out of the city centre. There are fields behind the house. There is a park leading up to it. There is no closed circuit TV. And clearly, it was eminently doable. Whoever did it, I imagine, in darkness, then escaped. And at some point, it seems they may have tossed away whatever it was they used to apply the Novichok. But we're slightly getting ahead of ourselves here because the police, they've identified the door handle, but they have not found the object used to smear the poison.
Well, obviously, the fact that Portendown is nearby, and by the way, the Russians have used the proximity of Portendown as a way to sow confusion and disinformation about the possible authors of this attack, when I think most people reasonably recognize that this is the hand of the Kremlin, as there was in the Alexander Litvinenko assassination, which, of course, you wrote about, Luke Harding, in A Very Expensive Poison, the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko and Putin's war with the West. Putin's war with the West continues, and we have a very strange situation where the President of the United States seems to be infatuated with Putin, at the same time be attacking our longest-standing allies. And, of course, as I mentioned in the beginning, Trump will be coming to the UK along with the meeting with NATO and then capping it all off with a meeting in Helsinki with Putin. Since you spent a lot of time in Russia between 2007 and 2011, when you were the Moscow bureau chief for The Guardian, before the Kremlin expelled you from the country, which was the first case of its kind since the Cold War, what's your understanding about the possible chain of command in terms of Putin giving this order, assuming that was the case? My understanding is that Nikolai Petrushev, his national security advisor, is a real hawk in the most dangerous sense. I think he makes our national security advisor, John Bolton, seem like a reasonable person.
A reasonable, moderate guy. Well, I mean, I think, first of all, there's a historical context that what's been happening under Putin, which is we've seen a slew of critics murdered, including journalists, including opposition leaders like Boris Nemtsov, who was gunned down in 2015. Most of these victims have been inside Russia. They've been Russians killed inside Russia, but there have also been these kind of extraterritorial operations like Litvinenko, like I think the Skripals, and that was really a hallmark of the Soviet era. I mean, you'll remember Trotsky being murdered with an ice pick, the reverse Ukrainian nationalists who were blown up in the 1930s, and other defectors. I think what's interesting is we don't know how the command structure works now, but I'm strongly of the view that it will be similar to how it was in Soviet times, where there is a body of literature from the KGB and others. And this was done orally, that Stalin didn't write a long memo saying kill Trotsky. He summoned his spy chief in the late 1930s, someone called Pavel Sudoplatov, and said, Pavel, you understand the political importance of your mission, which meant kill Trotsky. So it was an oral thing. Those sorts of assassinations were always approved by the Politburo and were done in conditions of total secrecy. So I think my view is that it's impossible for these kinds of internationally complicated and sensitive operations to go ahead where Russia's sort of international reputation is at play without the express approval of the president or people very close to him. So despite the official denials, I think that's the case. And the other thing I would say is just the view from Europe at the moment of President Trump is one of dismay, not just the Brits, but also other kind of European allies, confused and disheartened by the president's pretty relentless attacks on NATO, on the Germans, on the European Union, at the same time that Trump is being flattering and, I would say, almost subservient towards Vladimir Putin, whom he meets next week. And you ask yourself, how do you explain this? Well, I've written a book called Collusion, which traces Donald Trump's engagement with Moscow, both Soviet Moscow and Russia over the past 3 decades, financial and so on, and exploring the dossier of Christopher Steele, the famous dossier, which was published by BuzzFeed. And this is in the kind of protean, crazy presidency of Donald Trump, almost the one constant is his loyalty to Putin, above and beyond traditional U.S. loyalty to allies of 70, 80 years. This is very strange. This is not normal. And I can tell you there are going to be huge demonstrations against President Trump in London and other big cities when he arrives on Thursday.
Well, we've seen pictures of the baby Trump, which is going to be aloft, I believe. I don't know. Is it going to escape his view, or will he be forced to see?
I'm sure that Trump will not see the kind of floating baby sort of blimp Trump that I think is being launched on Friday morning above the streets of central London. Now, the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, of course, is a Muslim. I mean, he's a very secular Muslim, and has given permission for that to go ahead. And he, of course, is one of very many people that Trump has attacked. and essentially rather a British kind of riposte to Twitter is to build an inflatable man president child and fly him above the Houses of Parliament. But I suspect the president won't see it.
So is there a factor here, though, in terms of the hawkish nature of Putin's cabinet? My understanding is that there were some more sober figures that came out of the SVR and KGB, foreign intelligence, who had a more sophisticated view of the world, like his former chief of staff, Sergei Ivanov, who was the station chief in Stockholm, for example, and Kislyak, the former Russian ambassador to Washington. My understanding is that they were against this operation to meddle in the American elections and help elect Donald Trump. Is that what's happened there, that Putin has sort of, and it's the same problem we have in the White House, that there are very few adults left to speak truth to power. The only one left now is the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, and he's being isolated and marginalized. But the rest of them are either sycophants or hawks. And my understanding is that the same thing's happening in the Kremlin, that Putin is now surrounding himself with sycophants and hawks like Nikolai Petrushev, his national security advisor.
Yeah, I mean, there's something in that, although I think you have to be careful of the comparisons, because the U.S., I think, is still broadly a democracy, and Russia really, under Vladimir Putin, has never been a democracy. It's been an increasingly darkening authoritarian state. And you're right insofar as that the people who serve in the government with Putin are very often his cronies. They are quite often people with a KGB or intelligence background who see the world through through a Soviet lens, that their worldview is primarily, I would say, xenophobic. They regard America as the glavny protivnik, is the phrase in Russian, the main adversary, with Britain as a sort of junior adversary. And some of Putin's complexes, which we've seen manifested in recent years, the sense of Russia being besieged by a hostile West and so on, they come straight from the Soviet playbook. As is his response, which is to try and influence and subvert Western democracies, as we saw in 2016, spectacularly, to hack the U.S. election and to release damaging material to favor one candidate, Trump, and to disadvantage another, Hillary Clinton. And so this is, at its core, it's a kind of KGB state. And what's interesting is in Soviet times, the KGB was subordinate to the Communist Party. The Communist Party had supreme power in the Politburo. Whereas now, since Putin has been in charge since 2000, for almost 2 decades now, so the KGB, the modern FSB, are subordinate to nobody. It's a spy state run by rather overweight, middle-aged spies, and now in their 60s, who continue to see America as an enemy. And interestingly, if you look at Russian state TV has been saying some very sweet things about Donald Trump again, and describes Trump as ours. Naši is the verb in Russian. Our president. That's how he's referred to.
Well, indeed, and I understand that to some extent that has backfired in terms of trying to sort of gin up a hawkish posture with the United States, and perhaps that explains why they went after the more low-hanging fruit of the UK, and that is that since that is the pervasive feeling amongst Russians that Trump is our president, then the average Russian thinks, well, Putin's a genius. He owns our guy in the White House. Therefore, we don't have to worry about the Americans.
Well, I mean, that's right. But the thing is that there's a lot of sort of myth-making and storytelling that goes on there as well. I mean, that Trump is portrayed as being ours in the Russian state media. But they also go along with something that the kind of senior Republicans say. They say that Trump is a good guy, but a victim of the deep state, that he's under attack by liberals who are not reconciled to the election results, and that there are powerful forces in America ranged against him. And I think one of the most spooky and almost sort of sinister aspects of this is the synergy between what Donald Trump says, you know, witch hunt, unfair, etc., and what Russian propaganda says. I mean, they're like a kind of tag team. These two things kind of overlap. And I think what will be fascinating when Trump and Putin meet for their bilateral summit in Finland is when they have a one-on-one meeting, whether Trump, once again, as he did in Hamburg last year, dispenses with his official interpreter, with his official American interpreter, and just sits with Putin and with Putin's sort of translator at his side. In other words, that he wants to talk secretly to Vladimir Putin. Now, again, you have to ask yourself, if that is the case, I mean, he did that in Germany. If he does it again, why would he want to do that? And I think the answer is because he wants to discuss things that he doesn't want the American public to know about.
And indeed, it was worse than that at the last meeting they had, because the Russians told Trump that they didn't want Fiona Hill in the room because she speaks Russian and she wrote a book critical of Putin, operative in the Kremlin, and Trump acceded to it and went in there without a note taker and without a translator.
Well, right, and she has been she's been pretty much sort of shut out of the whole process. And without sort of focusing excessively on personalities, it's very, very hard to not do that with Donald Trump. It's also hard to see what substantively American policy towards Russia is. I mean, there seems to be a mood among certain Republicans that it's time to reset relations and to kind of move on. And you have to say, well, hang on a minute. I mean, Russia is the power that actually launched a hyper-aggressive attack on American democracy, unprecedented in 2016. It's the power that shredded European borders and annexed Crimea and kickstarted a war in eastern Ukraine in which 10,000 people have been killed, most of them civilians, and so on. And it's also the power we think that is behind the attack on Sergei Skripal and the death of a close ally. Now, I'd be very interested to see if Donald Trump says anything about this poisoning, this Novichok attack this week, either Theresa May or publicly, because what he tends to do when challenged about things like this is to kind of equivocate and say that we don't know. But in this case, the UK government has said very explicitly they think the Russian state is responsible. And if Trump, again, refuses to condemn, you have to ask yourself, why is that?
Well, a possible answer is, it's certainly in terms of what's happening with NATO and the subsequent meeting with Putin, is that, and you had those 8 U.S. Republican senators in Moscow over the 4th of July meeting with a group of top Russians, including this foreign secretary and Slava Nikonov and others, where the Russians said that was one of the best meetings they've ever had. So what I fear is that there's an effort underway to say that Russia is no longer an enemy. And once you establish that, if you can establish that as an alternative fact, then you don't need NATO.
Well, yeah, it's astonishing that we're even really having this kind of conversation. But yes, you're right. You're right. But the thing is, you just have to kind of bear in mind the way that the sort of presidential administration thinks in Moscow. I mean, Vladimir Putin is not interested in mutually beneficial solutions. He's a classic kind of zero-sum operator. He thinks that what is bad for America is good for Russia and vice versa. And what he wants to do is to make Russia great again, to make Russia a co-equal partner to the United States and a kind of co-arbiter in international affairs, whether we're talking about Iran or North Korea or Syria in the Middle East or Ukraine and so on. And Trump actually is fabulous news for Putin because he's like an accelerant poured into the American sort of domestic political process where there are ethnic tensions, there are political tensions, there are tensions over social issues, over the Supreme Court, over everything. And the U.S. is weakened. It's internally divided. It's consumed with two tribes shouting at each other. But meanwhile, this means that Vladimir Putin can kind of make foreign policy and make the weather. And so from his point of view, Trump is an ideal interlocutor. He is someone who I think he would probably regards as kind of lazy and weak and so on, and someone who is not an equal partner in any way. And so really, Putin has had an extraordinary couple of years, and I think his game plan is to just keep on doing what he's doing.
Well, Luke Harding, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Luke Harding, who's in the UK. He's a journalist, writer, and award-winning foreign correspondent for The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief before the Kremlin expelled him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. His books include A Very Expensive Poison, The Assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, and Putin's War with the West, The Snowden Files, The Inside Story of the World's Most Wanted Man, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, and WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy. Two have been made into Hollywood movies, and his books have been translated into 30 languages. And his latest book is Collusion, How Russia Helped Trump Win the White House. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Trump administration threatened small countries who were going to sign on to a international resolution to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding at the behest of big corporations who make baby formula. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Diane, who's a contributing writer to Salon.com and The Intercept, and a weekly columnist for The New Republic and The Fiscal Times, the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize. His latest book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Greatest Foreclosure Fraud. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, The U.S. Bullied the World to Stop a Pro-Breastfeeding Resolution. That's the American Way. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Diane.
Thank you for having me again.
And the New York Times did a fairly extensive expose on how the U.S. negotiators before the World Health Assembly sought to water down a resolution promoting breastfeeding by removing language that called on governments to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding. And they also wanted to remove another passage that called on policymakers to restrict the promotion of food products that many experts say have had a negative effect on the health of young children. So is this as naked as it appears that the baby formula lobby intervened?
Certainly looks that way. What they really wanted to do is stop this resolution altogether. the sponsor of the resolution was going to be the country of Ecuador. And the U.S. negotiators immediately confronted them and threatened trade sanctions and the withdrawal of military aid from Ecuador if they would introduce this resolution. And Ecuador backed down and said, we can't do that. And about a dozen other smaller countries did the same until, of all countries, Russia took the sort of cheap PR win by saying, okay, we'll introduce it. The U.S. did not threaten in the same way Russia as they did these other countries, and they then worked to water down the language. What you say, I think, is absolutely right. The baby formula industry is a $70 billion global industry that's concentrated among a handful of U.S. and European companies that control virtually all of that market. You know, three companies in the U.S. Control about 95% of the market. And those formula companies rely on misinformation, as particularly in the developing world, to sell their products and increase their output. And having a resolution at a public health UN-affiliated body that says breastfeeding is actually better for you would be a crimp in their profits, and they didn't want that, and it seems like they got the U.S. to be there, do their bidding on it.
So this is almost like a continuation of this post-truth American world of fake news, right?
In some ways, you know, and this goes back, 40, 50 years almost. The large companies, which includes Nestle, which is the owner of Gerber, have put out pamphlets in the developing world saying that breastfeeding is bad for you, or it doesn't give you the full amount of nutrients, it's not modern. And they've used that. They've also sort of funded third world hospitals and provided them with free samples, almost like a pusher giving a free hit to get somebody hooked. And they have used this very systematically to extend their reach across the world. And the problem is that this is so expensive. You're only talking about dehydrated milk and a few vitamins and a bunch of sugar, which is what they put in baby formula. But it costs a lot of money. And after they hook these poor families, the families end up diluting the formula with water to stretch it. And that leads to a lot of unnecessary deaths due to malnutrition. I mean, this is documented in reports from very credible health public health sources saying that there's close to 1 million deaths every year from malnutrition because of the use of baby formula. So, this is a really serious situation that the U.S. decided to intervene about.
To perpetuate the problem, as opposed to solve it.
Yeah, to perpetuate the problem and to perpetuate the profits of this industry, which consists of mainly Nestle, the makers of Gerber, Abbott Laboratories, which is a large conglomerate and makes a formula called Similac, and Mead Johnson, which was once part of Bristol-Myers Squibb. It's now its own company through a British subsidiary that makes Enfamil. And that's really it. It's those three companies making billions and billions of dollars in profits off it.
So you've got these three companies, Abbott Labs, Mead Johnson, and Nestle, controlling the market for infant formula, mm-hmm. with Abbott and Mead Johnson 80% of the market, and Gerber, division of Nestle, 15% of the market. And as you point out, all that's selling basically is dehydrated cow's milk with vitamins and lots of sugar. But somehow or other, it costs $150 a month to feed it to an American baby. So how can people in the third world, you're lucky to get $150 a year? I mean, give us a break. What's going on here?
That's precisely the point. And you know, those prices, that $150 a month, that's U.S. prices. They may be different in other parts of the world, but we know that it's priced at a point that's too expensive for poor families in emerging countries in the developing world to really deal with. And that's why you see all these malnutrition cases, because they're not using the formula in such a way. They're over diluting it. They're not ensuring that the proper amount of nutrition gets to their babies, because they've been sold this disinformation that you have to use formula, you can't do breastfeeding. And this has been going on for a long time. It's been going on for like 40 years. And we have now enough credible science to show that breastfeeding is really a far better option for young mothers. And it's really one of the more appalling things I think the Trump administration has done, to intervene on behalf of this industry to prop up their profits at the expense of children.
And of course, Trump is tweeting out today that the New York Times got it wrong without saying what they got wrong. But is this right. A case of these big corporations, these multinational corporations that control the baby formula market, that have apparently lobbied the Trump administration to essentially make fools of America before a global forum, just like getting out of the Paris Accords and these other multilateral agreements have essentially made the U.S. an outlier in the eyes of most of the world. But is this a case where these big corporations have seen their sales drop domestically because American women are becoming more educated to the importance and the value of breastfeeding, and therefore they're going to look for overseas markets? The same thing that happened, for example, with the tobacco industry when Americans stopped using tobacco because finally they were told the truth about the health warnings and the consequences of smoking.
That's right.
Moved to the third world, right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, if you look at the sort of financials of these companies, they have essentially flatlined on sales in the industrialized world. And that's for two reasons. Number one, the scientific evidence that's built up and more interest in breastfeeding. It's also become easier. There's more public spaces that are available for breastfeeding. There's less stigma attached to it. There is cheaper availability of breast pumps and things like that, even free through Obamacare. And also birth rates are lower in the industrialized world than they were 30, 40 years ago. So for all those reasons, sales of baby formula have been essentially flat in the industrialized world. And so to make up for that, you need to bring up your product in the developing world.
So, I mean, I suppose nobody would want to ban or eradicate baby formula because obviously some women can't breastfeed.
Right.
And while the entire medical community, as far as I know, and the pediatric community all say that the breast milk is much healthier for a infant and a developing child, is there any way to make this baby formula more healthy? I mean, in other words, corporate food is pretty will kill you. You know, if you eat Pringles and all that stuff that they manufacture, you'll have a very short Hobbesian life.
Right. I mean, I think taking out the sugar might help. You know, you're giving your infant child the equivalent of a candy bar. So that would be one thing. One thing I would say here is that this is part of sort of a broader trend. I mean, we can bash the Trump administration for doing this, but the truth is that there's been a broad sort of bipartisan consensus that trade can be used as sort of a weapon to get corporate interests plugged in to, communities all over the world. I mean, we've seen this over and over and over again, particularly on public health issues, whether it's protecting pharmaceutical patents so that HIV and AIDS drugs can't be accessible to poor countries, or you're talking about banning labeling on junk food and soda to make sure that other countries can't discourage the use of those products. We have seen this so many times, and things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all these other recent trade agreements really are sort of corporate wish lists at their heart. And so it's in some ways not surprising to see the Trump administration threaten a country with trade sanctions if they will operate in the interests of the public health of their own citizens. That is something that has been repeated over the last 40 years plus of the modern sort of global trade consensus. And it's something we need to think about. You know, Trump is supposed to be disrupting trade, but he's on this issue, at least on corporate handouts, he's doing exactly what's been done for the last several decades. And if we do happen to replace him in future administrations, we need to think about not just restoring sort of the status quo of the global trading system, but really attacking this sort of corporate friendly agenda that inevitably creates the kind of backlash that leads to someone like Trump. So I think that's what this issue really animates to me, is that as much as there's been this change and disruption in the way that Donald Trump looks at trade, in some ways it's just more of the same.
Well, just in closing, David Dane, do you expect to hear anything from Ivanka Trump? She's the champion for women and children. She's been very silent on the Trump administration ripping children from the arms of their parents at the border. And certainly on the possibility that Amy Barrett, an anti-abortion zealot, will be Trump's next nominee, which we'll learn about in a few minutes, although Hardiman looks more likely now. He's apparently a friend of Trump's sister, who's a federal judge, and more likely to be approved without a fight. So we'll know about that. But I'm being a little facetious or perhaps even unkind. But I must say that I find Ivanka Trump's posturing rather at odds with her father's policies.
Well, if it's anything like previous issues, we'll hear some anonymous sources saying that Ivanka was very angry about this issue, and she tried to get her father to change his mind. You know, it's really all about protecting Ivanka's brand rather than actually advancing any cause of justice or public health or anything like that. So that's typically how these things have run.
Well, David Dane, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Dane, who's a contributing writer to Salon.com and The Intercept and a weekly columnist for The New Republic and The Fiscal Times, the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize. His latest book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And he has an article at The Los Angeles Times, The U.S. Bullied the World to Stop a Pro-Breastfeeding Resolution. That's the American way. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.